one nowadays that people are falling in love with, where it'll measure the resistive and reactive component of your antenna and sweep it in frequency and tell you what the visuar and give you a curve on the screen. Some of those are very nice and a little bit more pricey. Anyone else with any further comment on handheld instrumentation like this, give me your call letters right now, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Mike, Yankee.
I'm sorry, it's not a question about this, and I don't mean to hold up the TechNet, but I was just, I heard Rich on, and Rich, how are you doing with the rig?
Doing good, James. It'll be, next week, I think we'll have it for you. Let me turn it back to Ned, M2EO.
Very fine, Rich. And Ray, you want to make another comment? Go right ahead. Mike Yankee, K2LIW.
Yeah, he said he was going to Amazon. The only thing about Amazon is they get you on the shipping, so the price might not really be cheaper. And I saw on a YouTube, I was looking at some meters. You want to make sure you get one with the highest ammeter function, the amps that it'll take. And you also want to make sure it has microvolts on them, because some of the cheaper ones don't go all the way down to microvolts. So there's a couple of parameters you want to look for. And Dick, I just wanted to know if I was right in assuming that if P equals V squared over R at 100 watts on my HF rig, am I getting about 70 volts on the RF? And that will be my last question. And thank you so much. I'll be asking you things about electronics as I think of them in future TechNet. Thank you.
Without a doubt, power equals E squared over R or V squared over R, and you can solve for E. E is going to be equal to the square root of power times R. If I'm using a 50-ohm load, and if I'm using a 50-watt transmitter, if my power was 50 watts and my output impedance of the transmitter is 50 ohms, I take the multiplication of those two and take the square root of them, I'm going to end up with 50 volts. In other words, a 50-watt transmitter on a 50-ohm line is giving you 50 volts of RMS power. Got to be careful now. When you're looking that on an oscilloscope, you're going to be measuring peak to peak on the oscilloscope, and RMS is a little bit different. There's ways to convert from one to the other, but you've got the formula correct most likely, and I've just given you an example. 50 volts, 50-ohm line, 50 watts transmitter. That's one place where they come together is a nice, easy one to remember. Obviously, you're going to get more volts with more power. If I was running, instead of 50 watts, 500 watts, 10 times higher in power would be 3 and a fraction times higher in voltage. I'd have around 160 volts or so for a 500-watt transmitter, just to give you a... And the 70 volts you talked about probably was a 100-watt transmitter. Like I could plug it into my handheld calculator, but most likely you did that calculation for a 100-watt transmitter. You came up with 70.7 volts RMS. And is that approximately what you did, Ray? KC2, Mike Yankee, K2LIW.
Yes, sir, you got it right on. That's what I calculated, and now I'm sure that's what it is. And that's it. So thank you very much. Back to Ned.
Now, one of the things you're about to discover, if you happen to make some of the mistakes that John and I made in our early days, under normal circumstances, if I had 70 volts coming out of a transformer that's connected to the 60-cycle LOCO or LIPA power line, or Con Ed power line, I got 60 cycles at 70 volts RMS, and I put my hands across it. It's way beyond the point where it could create an uncomfortable shock and could, in theory, create a lethal shock. 70 volts, if you got large enough contacts, your hands are wet enough, and you're making good squeeze on those terminals, 70 volts could get you in trouble. If now, in the process of you testing your transmitter, you put your finger across the 50-ohm connector inside the transmitter, if you're doing the dangerous thing of operating the transmitter with the cover off, and you're poking your finger in there, and you put your finger across the 100-watt output terminal, you'll find out you will not get a shock. Because of the skin effect, all of the RF energy will flow across the outer skin of your body. None of it will penetrate inside down to the blood level. You'll not be having any defibrillation characteristics, if you know what I mean. That's the good news. The bad news is that current flowing on the skin creates heating, and you'll get a blister, you'll get a white lump of dead white flesh on that finger that came across those contacts. We call that an RF burn. It usually is a white chunk of of callus-like thing that forms in a day or two. When you so RF energy, when you put your finger directly across it, it doesn't have the usual shocking danger. It has a heating danger. Don't do it. But I'm just telling you what I have experienced. I'm going to turn it over to John, because I'll bet you he has experienced something like that in his days. KC2 WGB, K2RIW. You got it, John.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Dick. Those RF burns, I had quite a few of them when I was younger. And, yeah, it's not going to hurt you, but it will burn you. And usually you'll get two dots, one on each side of your finger where you cross it, and it looks almost like a wart, and it goes away after a while. But it can be uncomfortable. And, oh, by the way, Amazon also charges sales tax. Where on eBay, if it's out of state, you're not going to charge sales tax. But you're right about the RF burns, Dick.
As you can see, Ray and Joe and Jim, RF energy behaves quite differently. And the word ground, as we've discussed from time to time, the word ground at an RF frequency has a very different meaning. I mean, when we ground our pieces of equipment, we do it for three reasons. Number one is for 60-cycle shock safety advantage. In other words, you'd like your piece of equipment to never have a chassis that's hot with reference to the water pipes in the house. Because if you touch the water pipe with one hand and the chassis of the rig with the other, and there's 120 volts on the chassis of the rig, that's a bad sign. And so the grounding circuit, the third prong of your plug in the wall, that safety wiring is supposed to make sure that that cannot happen. So human safety is the main reason we do grounding. The second reason we do grounding is for lightning protection. But when it comes to control of RF energy, where it goes, the word grounding sometimes doesn't do anything like what you think it's going to do. And that's another very mysterious subject. I think the next person on the list is... Oh, why don't we... we're already beyond 9 o'clock. It's time for Mel's Corner. Hey, John, what kind of deep probing subjects have you had in your mailbag this week? KC2 at WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, KC2 WGB, sort of sitting in Mel's chair here, looking at the mailbag, and got a goodie for you here. Let me let it drop. Okay, this gentleman, Barry, he has a little problem. He has a 2-meter rig, and it's a 25-watt rig. He can't run it continuously at 25 watts, but he can manage 10 to 15 watts, no problem at all. He can run it 24 hours a day. Now, the issue is he wants to buy a linear, so he wants recommendations, what to look for, and will 10 to 15 watts as an exciter be sufficient to develop 300 watts, because he wants to buy a 300-watt linear. Now, I know we don't recommend brands, but maybe you could give him some tips on what to look for, what's important, and what he should let slide.
There's sort of a yes and a no when it comes to brands. When it comes to linear amplifiers for the 2-meter band, for instance, I think it's 2 meters we're talking about, yes, there's only three brands that I can remember right now. Tokyo High Power, Mirage, and I'm having trouble thinking of the third one right now, but it'll come to me in a minute. Each of those will have an amplifier. For instance, Mirage does have an amplifier that'll put out 180 watts with 10 input. That happens to be the Model 1016, Mirage Model 1016. The 1016 means 10 watts in, and the 16 means you add a zero to it, and it's got 160 watts of output. And when you put 13.8 volts into that, I get 180 watts out of mine. Tokyo High Power. By the way, each of these brick amplifiers, solid-state brick amplifiers that you can buy, usually have a version that requires 10 watts in, 30 watts in, and so on. In other words, how many of the low-level drive stages they include in your particular model number determines how much drive power it needs. And where his 2-meter rig can put out 15 watts continuously, but 25 watts only for a short period of time, that's what I think he's saying. Maybe it's because of an overheating problem. Quite often, a rig will have an internal fan, and if it's a rig that's more than 10 years old, there may be a whole lot of dust in that fan. And so, taking it apart, cleaning it out, making sure the fan is working correctly is one approach. if the rig has a heat sink on the back, directing a fan at it, at the heat sink, could allow you to run 25 watts continuously without overheating it. So there's various ways around that. When you go from 25 watts of a rig up to 250 watts, I rounded off the 300 watts down to 250 because that way it's exactly a 10 to 1 ratio. If I go from 25 watts up to 250 watts by way of an amplifier, that's a 10 to 1 power increase. That's a 10 decibel increase. That's the one case when it's a 10 to 1 power ratio. That's the one place where the power ratio and the decibel ratio happen to be the same. Just the way the mathematics works out. A 10 decibel increase is about 1.5 S units. It's a significant increase, without a doubt, but it's not always going to be night and day. If you want real good performance on 2 meters, you've got about 3 choices. One, you can put your antenna wherever it is on a higher location. Number 2, you can build or buy a higher gain antenna. Number 3, you can use lower loss feed line. Number 4, you can combine all of them. Build, say for instance, a coat hanger type antenna that you aim at your favorite repeater, a 3-element, 4-element, 5-element coat hanger Yagi antenna. Use low loss feed line mounted at a high location. You can easily make your signal 15 or 20 decibels louder. That's a 100 to 1 ratio of apparent power. And in some cases, 30 dB improvement, a 1,000 to 1 increase, just by working on the antenna all by itself. If you happen to live on the first floor of an apartment building, and now you're transmitting through those marble canyons to try to get a signal out under the horizon on, say, for instance, 2-meter single sideband or 2-meter FM, and by one means or another, you mount an antenna on the roof, feed it with low-loss feed line, aim the antenna in the right direction, or use a high enough gain omnidirectional antenna, in that environment, you could easily make your signal 30 decibels louder by working on the antenna only, even before you start running a high-power amplifier. High-power amplifiers, they do make the signal stronger. That's the good news. But they come with a couple of problems. A 300-watt amplifier running on a 14-volt to 13.8-volt power supply is going to need, 30 or 40 amperes. It's going to have real good wiring, a well-protected power supply with over-voltage protection. There's a number of things that can go wrong. The people who have used high-power solid-state amplifiers in the 200, 300, 400-watt class, they tend to get a fair number of failures. In other words, the reliability of the rig beyond the first year and a half would give you about 75% reliability beyond the first year and a half. You talk to any of the guys running very high-power VHF ranked amplifiers, I'll bet you 25% of those guys have had to replace the final stage at some time. That's what I've been hearing, but maybe I've been hearing only the bad news. Wonder what you've been hearing along those lines, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yes, I've heard that. I've not heard it on the Tokyo. They seem to be doing a pretty good job. But the Mirage and the or something like that, those outputs were changed like 2-3 years down the line. And they're not cheap either. So it's something to be on guard for, without a doubt.
Yeah, if you work on the antenna to make your signal stronger, you get a lot for your money because now the antenna is giving you an improvement on transmission, multiplying your power by 10 or 100 times, maybe even 1,000 times, and you're getting it on reception when you work on the antenna. You're now going to hear things much further away than you've ever heard before. Weaker signals much further away. So you get a double, you get a 2.5 times benefit. You get more reliability. You get better reception range and much better transmission range, and people who say you used to be noisy into the repeater, now you're dead full quieting, you get all of that simultaneously when you work on the antenna. My recommendation is work on the antenna first, then antenna and feed line and altitude of the antenna and location of the antenna. Try to get it clear of the trees, clear of the nearby buildings, above them if at all possible, low loss feed line, right kind of antenna, aimed in the right direction. They give you tremendous benefits. After that, if you still want to be a bigger gun than adding extra amplifiers, but the amplifiers, they come at a price. They're not cheap, and they're not super reliable. part of what I think goes on is many of the amplifiers do not have built-in differential keying. By that I mean you press the push the torque button. In many cases, the person hasn't wired the external triggering of the amplifier. There's ways that you can take a terminal out of your transmitter that closes a relay contact when you press the push the torque button on your microphone. That in turn turns the transmitter on the high power amplifier. Many guys say, gee, the RF switching is good enough. In other words, the way the amplifier is built, it senses the fact that the drive power has arrived, it rectifies some of that, and then it starts turning on the amplifier and flipping its relay. Well, if you really study what's going on, the relay takes 20 milliseconds to throw from the receive mode to the transmit mode, but the transmitter comes on.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
But the transmitter comes on the air in a microsecond. So the transmitter gets keyed, in a microsecond he's cranking out full 300 watts of power during the time the relay contacts are open, and 20 milliseconds later the relay contacts, the electromechanical relay, finally closes. So for 19.99 milliseconds, the transmitter is running into an open circuit, and that's a very heavy impact on the final stage. To run into an open circuit, depending on the length of wire into that open circuit, could be very damaging to that final stage. It can create secondary breakdown. So many of these circuits, the way they're being used, because you're not externally keying the amplifier, and just the way it's designed, this lack of good differential keying is a problem. The guys who operate microwave equipment have learned a long time ago, you've got to build a fancy time differential keying circuit. The way that circuit works is that you've given the command somewhere by pressing down the key, by squeezing the mic button, whatever. You've given a command that I want to transmit now. And the way the circuit works is it senses that command. It immediately sends that command to the relay to start throwing the relay, the electromechanical relay, between the receive mode and the transmit mode. It waits until those contacts have moved and have stopped bouncing and have settled down, and then it enables the transmitter with the contacts already closed and the low noise amplifier being protected. And when you go back to the receive mode, it does the opposite. When you decide to stop squeezing the mic, it kills the transmitter first, and at a later time, it allows the relay to start moving, because if the relay is in transition while you're transmitting, two things happen. For a period of time, the transmitter is running into an open circuit, and two, the relay has very little isolation when that read inside of it is in the transition mode. You could be, for milliseconds, pouring 300 watts into the front end of your low noise
repeater, timeout, cancel.
For a significant period of time, you could be pouring 300 watts into the front end of your low noise amplifier transistor. So anybody who is running electronic equipment on top of the tower with a low noise amplifier, if he doesn't have time differential keying on his amplifier, it's only a very short period of time before he's got to replace that low noise amplifier transistor. So time differential keying, external keying, and whatever, these are some of the variables you got to consider if you want reliability in that kind of a circuit. Over to you, John, for the next one. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, that differential problem is probably what Wesley's running into on his Kenwood 2000X. That's a very good point. I know his antenna, Barry's antenna, is up about 50 feet. He didn't tell me whether it's a Yagi or a vertical light. I don't know. But he looks at, he wants to get into DXT. So those are some great recommendations. And if you're listening, Barry, at least you know where to start. And maybe you could do a little antenna work, and maybe you won't need that kicker. Or maybe you'd need one that's a lot smaller. Let me let it drop. I'll go to the second one. KZ2WGV. Okay, this comes from George, who's in Manhattan. All right, he's working on his power supply on his radio. He needs to replace some electrolytics. Maybe you can give him a little rundown on electrolytics. They are 80 mics at 250 volts. He has found 100 mics at 250 volts now, and he would like to know if he could use those. He also wants to replace some 50s, and I think that was it, 50 and 280. So maybe you can give him some tips on that. Also, he's asking about diodes. If it's okay to replace a 2.5 amp diode with the same PVI with a 5-amp diode, or can he cause a problem by doing that? So, back to you, Dick, for comments.
Yeah, when we use older equipment, tube-type equipment, that had electrolytic capacitors, and by the values that he's giving us, 80 mics and 250 volts, it sounds like tube equipment. Very few transistor equipment uses capacitors rated for 250 volts. One of the things you'll discover is that those electrolytic capacitors, when they're brand new, they work very well, but they have a finite age to them. Electrolytic material, the liquid inside, eventually dries out because, with rare exception, there is not a hermetic seal. And some of the valuable liquid eventually evaporates and the capacitor starts changing. You take, for instance, the 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor. That is the main motor-running capacitor that's in all of your Cornell Dubilier antenna rotators, the CDE antenna rotators, Cornell Dubilier antenna rotators. The main running capacitor is 120 microfarads. And so as that capacitor starts drying out, the amount of torque you get out of that rotator gets lower and lower, and eventually on a cold day it doesn't move. You think that the grease has dried out. You think that that the rotator is frozen or whatever. It's almost always that capacitor that's inside of the sending unit down in the shack that's doing it. You replace that with a brand new motor start capacitor, AC electrolytic capacitor, at the same number of microfarads. There, the number of microfarads is critical because there's a kind of a resonance going on between the two windings that gives you 90 degrees of phase shift that makes the motor rotate clockwise or counterclockwise. So in that particular case, if the original capacitor was 120 microfarads, it would be nice to replace the brand new one 120 microfarads. Let me drop. But when it comes to an ordinary rectifier network and power supply, there's nothing magic about the exact number of microfarads. That 80 microfarad, 250 volt capacitor that he's got, that he's replacing, if you put it on the right kind of instrumentation, and here it is 20 years downrange from the time it was manufactured, and he measured it, he probably would find it's got 5 microfarads left of the original 80 because it has dried out. Until it got down below 10 microfarads, the circuit probably continued to work. There's nothing magic about the exact number of microfarads in a power supply, with rare exception. And as you increase the number of microfarads, you get better and better filtering. Almost never do you run into problems. So if the 80 mics, he replaces it with 100 or 150, it's going to work like a charm. When you go up in microfarads on a power supply, with rare exception, the more the microfarads, the better. The only reason why the manufacturer didn't put more in there in the beginning is it would cost him more in either size or dollars. So up in microfarads is good. When it comes to replacing diodes, let me drop. With rare exception, if the diode you're plugging in has the same or higher peak inverse voltage, PIV rating, and if the diode you're plugging in has the same ampere rating or greater, with rare exception, bigger diodes, heavier diodes, bigger capacitors, all of these things are better and better and better, if you know what I mean. There's a couple of exceptions to that, and that is the very first time you turn on the power supply. If Con Ed happens to be going through the peak of voltage at the instant you close the switch, as you go to bigger number of microfarads and a larger rating of the diode, the total internal resistance of that is a little bit smaller, and that starting surge current could be a little bit greater. And there's a slim possibility you get a little bit more arcing of those contacts, but these are rare situations. Also, when it comes to the current rating of the diode, there's 2 or 3 different current ratings you should be concerned about. One is average current rating. The other one is a peak current rating for one cycle. When you first turn on the power supply ice cold and the capacitor is uncharged, then you're putting a very large amount of current into that diode. The diode might be rated for 5 amperes, but it may be able to, according to inspection sheet, be able to tolerate 25 amperes as a single cycle event on the startup of the power supply. So if you want to be doubled on sure, you make sure you have at least compatibility with the average current rating and hopefully current compatibility when it comes to the single cycle peak current rating. But from my experience, John, more microfarads is better. more amperes on the diode is better, more peak inverse voltage on the diode is better, with rare exception. And once in a blue moon, you run into some kind of a funny resonance in a pi filter network of a power supply, but it's pretty rare. KC2WGB, what's your experience along these lines?
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
As I was starting to say, what's your experience along these lines, John? Go right ahead and wait for the beeps, K2RAW.
Oh, I'm in full agreement, Dick. A couple of more microfarads can't hurt, and as long as the physical size is not a problem, and you don't have to do any alteration there, if you've got 120 mic, 150 mic, put it in there. The diodes, I find that as long as the PIV is right, or better, you'll have no problem at all. And I've never run into that problem with the power supply, with it starting to break out. I know people have run into it, but I've never done that in substituting the diodes or capacitors. So, and these are things he has on hand, and he was just reluctant to put them in until he checked with us to make sure. So I'm sure he'll be relieved to hear that.
Yeah, one final comment. If the particular electrolytics he has on hand, even though if they're brand new, right off the shelf, so to speak, but they have been on that shelf for 20 years, worry about the fact that even in non-use, they could be drying out. So any method by which you can measure the number of microfarads, and also another thing that happens with electrolytics, sometimes they've got to slowly be brought up in voltage. You've got to form the plate, so to speak, if they have been sitting thoroughly discharged for, let me pick a number, 10 years. By the way, some of these electrolytic capacitors, if you turn them on for the very first time in 10 years, they may not have the full rating capability until you slowly sneak up on that voltage and they get a chance to reform the plates. So a better rated capacitor, if it's been sitting on the shelf for 10 years, you might have to treat it a little bit more carefully at first. Over to you on that one, John. K2RAW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. Anytime I do a power supply repair, whether it's for slot state or for tube job, I always bring it up on a variac in about 10-volt increments and allow those things to reform and cure themselves because you can perforate them. I've had it happen. And they were brand-new capacitors, but who knew how long they were on the shelf at the distributor? You know, like you say, it could be 10 years. They look brand-new, but and testing them isn't foolproof. So the best thing, even if they check good, is to bring them up incrementally and then keep your power supply measurements going and let it maybe even let it charge 20 minutes at maybe 60 to 80% of the rate of your DC power supply and then bring it up to the full voltage, and I don't think you'll have any problem. If it works from the startup, fine. Then it's about all I can remember. And I have had problems with larger capacitors causing the fuse, if you actually look at the fuse with a magnifying glass, when you turn it on, you see they always weep. Sometimes they'll weep a little more, and that's fatigue, but you could always check that by going up another quarter of an ampere.
Yeah, Rich recognized. So I think what you're saying, John, is what you do is that you connect your power supply to a variac, start off with 60% or so of normal voltage, and then slowly creep up over an hour or so period of time in order to let the electrolytic capacitors slowly reform themselves, because a thoroughly discharged electrolytic capacitor sitting on the shelf, never connected to any circuit, really is going through a kind of temporary aging process where the plate, the positive and negative plates inside the capacitor, lose some of their characteristic until the right voltage has been slowly brought up on them. And another thing to worry about is an electrolytic capacitor. It's got a clearly marked positive and negative terminal. If you ever reverse the polarity on one of those, all hell can break loose. You can literally explode the thing. So be careful to make sure you wire it with the right polarity. I wonder if you ever run into some of these problems, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Yeah, funny you mentioned. I didn't reverse the polarity, but about a year ago, or maybe it was 6 months ago, I lost track. I fired up a piece of vintage equipment, and I did not bring it up on a variac. And it's a good thing I turned my head when I did, because that capacitor went off like a bomb. It I noticed that the lights would dim on the radio. The thing was had a leakage, and it got hotter than a firecracker, an electrolytic can, like a, I think it was a 40-40-40 and 450. I don't know what it blew my head off, but I wasn't a happy camper. And what I was going to suggest, Dick, in lieu of a variac, which is the best way to bring it up, another trick is you can put a 50 or 100-watt light bulb, regular incandescent bulb, and fuse with one side of the AC line. Let it cook with that for a while. Then jump the light bulb out.
Yeah, there's a catch on that one now, Rich, and that is, if it is, let me pick a number, a 12-volt, 3-ampere power supply, which ordinarily is only drawing, let me pick a number, 50 milliamps out of the 110-volt line, and you put a 60-watt light bulb in series with that particular power supply, because when that power supply is unloaded, it draws so little current that even with your light bulb in series, you may be putting 105 or 110 volts of 115 into the power supply. So you have to do a little bit of mathematics there to choose the right rating in watts of the light bulb, depending on what you believe is the standby current of your power supply when it's unloaded. But still, whenever you're turning on any kind of a transformer or 110 volt power equipment, where ordinarily you would have a fuse to protect you in cases of short circuit, if you put it in series with, let me pick a number, a 100-watt light bulb, then no matter what you're testing, whether it be a transformer that might have a dead short, a power supply that might have a dead short, a television set that might have a dead short, the fact that you're putting it in series with a 100-watt light bulb, that means that when the piece of equipment is powered up and it presents its dead short, the only thing that happens is the 110-volt light bulb lights at full brilliance, which is giving you a clue. And no damage. It's a lot nicer than blowing fuses. So that's a very crafty way of turning on any kind of a circuit the first time, is to put it in series with a light bulb if it hasn't had 110-volt power on it for some significant amount of time. Over to you, John, and go to the next one if you want to. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, you too, Jack.
Let's see what Eric's got to say. Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, just as a comment. When you put a light bulb in series, for example, when I was a young kid and I used to fix the audio amplifiers, that was the preferred method of doing it, because if you have the light bulb in there, and typically most audio amplifiers, they would come in and they would have shorted output transistors. So rather than making more damage and blowing up the power supply, the light bulb would light up. It is actually the typical way that I like to work on unknown pieces of equipment, and as a standard piece of equipment on my test bench, to always have the 100 or 150 volt light bulb that I plug the device into through an isolation transformer, because many of the today's or even yesterday's stuff, when you use a scope that's grounded, because of some of them have switching supplies, and actually one side of the chassis will be hooked to ground, and you don't want to be hooking it so you can get dead short through the power line. But it's a typical service guy's kind of approach to things, and it's very effective. Unfortunately, with the discontinuance of the filament type light bulb, it's going to become more and more difficult to find the light bulb to put in that situation. K2RIWK is there.
Yeah, I think the problem we're going to run into, Eric, is that with our light-emitting diodes and our compact fluorescent tubes we've got these days, it's nowhere near as easy to do. The good news is they're very efficient. They don't draw much current. The bad news is because they don't draw much current, and the current they draw is not a pure sine wave anymore. You heat up the filament of a 100-watt light bulb. On each one of those 60 cycles, it acts like a pure 100-ohm, 120-ohm resistor. And so these compact fluorescent tubes, which has got a kind of a rectifying power supply inside, and these light-emitting diodes that have a similar kind of a power supply, it's a very nonlinear load, and so this characteristic that we used to have, we don't have anymore. So maybe we electronic enthusiasts have to go out and buy a whole lot of 100-watt and 30-watt light bulbs before they disappear so we continue to run our test bench. Is that what you're about to do, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW?
KQIWT. Believe it or not, actually it reminds me of the old days when I was like, I guess I was about seven or eight. I had this thing called an edge kit. And it had a resistor line cord. And depending upon whether you put 1, 2, or 3, and 7, a few other optical type tubes together, you'd wire the filament in series and use the resistor elements of the line cord. And the line cord would get hot according to how much did you, how many filaments you put together. But yeah, actually with it being in the broadcast biz and having all the spare bulbs for the lighting that we use, even that's going away. But yeah, I still have the backup of the good old, halide type of light bulb to back myself up on. But I got a few boxes, 100 watt bulbs, 150 watt bulbs. And the other thing is they're a little big. I got the beacon bulbs for the tower. They're not likely to stop manufacturing them because even the FAA at this point hasn't type accepted certain kinds of LED fixtures for that. So in that case, we'll be lucky, but you actually have to go looking for them if you want. But places like China, I'm sure they're just still manufacturing filament type light bulbs. They're just not supposed to be sold in this country. K2RIW, K2J.
Good information, Eric. But that beacon light bulb of yours is a 650 watt bulb. That draws the dawn much current. And now it doesn't give you quite as much protection if I was measuring a 12 volt 3 ampere power supply. And I put it in series with a 650 watt beacon bulb. And by definition, one of the things you got to know about is that most incandescent light bulbs, the cold resistance and the hot resistance of that filament is more than 10 to 1, sometimes 15 to 1. A 100 watt light bulb, when it's fully hot, draws up 1 ampere, and therefore the actual resistor inside the bulb itself goes to something like 140 ohms. When that bulb is ice cold, and you put your ohm meter across it, you might measure 10 ohms instead of 140. That means the surge current when you first turn it on is not 1 ampere. It could easily be 15 or so amperes instead of 1 ampere when you first turn it on. So incandescent bulbs have got this very peculiar characteristic of a huge change.
We need marker lights.
What about the marker? How many watt light bulb is your marker light? Eric, go ahead.
Depends on the height of your tower. Some marker lights are 45 watts, others are 60 watts, and some others are 120 watts. So there's a couple of stuff you can work with there.
I think you were telling me at another time that your main red beacon on the top of the tower, I believe, is a special 650 watt, very special bulb. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, typical beacon bulb, 620 watts, 675 watts. They also make them 800, 900 watts, but that's what you're doing if you're charging with power, which I don't have to deal with. I believe the beacon light on Empire, which was just recently changed, that's a 720 watt bulb.
And I've been threatening to mail you a picture of the guy who does the changing, who is the president of the company that makes the antennas. He just loves climbing high towers, and Empire is one of his favorite places. Okay, how big is your collection of 50-watt, 60-watt, 100-watt incandescent light bulbs to run your safety circuits in your laboratory, John? And you can go on to the next one if you want. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I got a couple of those mobile-based 620-watt aviation lamps. And yeah, they do draw a lot of current. But I'll tell you one thing I used to use before I had a lot of different variacs. I used to put a Bell transformer in series and a voltmeter on the output of the Bell transformer. And if I had full voltage, I knew I had a short. And the short went away, the voltage dropped. It worked well.
That's a very good suggestion. But by way of things like a Bell transformer, which takes 120 volts on the primary, and the secondary voltage is a hell of a lot lower, and it runs your doorbell circuit. It draws a lot less current, and therefore it's a good safety fuse for testing 110 volt unknown pieces of electronics of low power level. Now, if you try to test that in series with a say, a television set that you know is an old-fashioned one with a cathode ray tube and it's going to draw 300 watts, then 95% of your voltage is always going to be dropped across the Bell transformer, and you won't get a good test, if you know what I mean. So, as you can tell, whatever you put in series, light bulb, Bell transformer, and so on, has to be somewhat sized appropriately for what you believe is the normal current drain of the device under test. But still, it's a very nice way of testing. I'd much rather light up a light bulb or ring a bell than to keep replacing fuses. I've seen people replacing fuses while they try to fix things, and pretty soon they run out of boxes of fuses. Over to you for the next one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Jim. Well, the last one's an easy one for you. Gentleman by the name of Bob. Now, he has two receivers running, and he has a speaker on each one, external speakers. And now he wants to put an L pad so that he can switch from one to the other, or just lower one without eliminating, so that the one with more presence would be able to pay attention to it. He'd like to know how an L pad works and how to hook it up. Back to you, Dick.
Now, I may not understand the whole question yet. There's an L pad. At first, I would think you have various kinds of filter-like networks you put on hi-fi loudspeakers to divide the signal that goes to the woofer and the tweeter. And I don't think you're describing that. I think you just can't get to all that. I think it's impedance matching. Is that what you're saying? Eric, go ahead.
L-pad typically keeps constant impedance at the front end, usually 8 or 16 ohms. And that changes the volume up and down. It presents the same load to the amplifier.
Understand. So what I think you're saying, Eric, is that maybe the audio amplifier you've got has got a 16-ohm output, which is one of the standards, but your particular loudspeaker is a 4-ohm loudspeaker, and you want to put an L-pad in between the two to do an impedance match and yet keep the frequency response flat. Is that the question, if I understand it correctly? Back to you, John.
No, Dick. An L-pad is two wire-wound pots ganged, actually. And when one is being lowered, the other one is being increased because the wiring is opposite. They're wired differently. So that your signal coming to the center contact, if you go to the right, it will go, say, to the right speaker. And as you go to the left, it will lower the right speaker and increase the volume on the left speaker. Got the concept?
Okay, I think you're describing what I would describe as a balancing control. In other words, left versus right, you're trying to make the volume equal in this particular room. And you've got this dual pot assembly that lowers the resistance on one side, raises it on the other side, in order to equalize left versus right volume of two nearly identical loudspeakers. Is that approximately the scene, John? Over to you, John. K2RIW.
That's incorrect.
Dick, it could be a fader. An L-pad will just shift the amount of energy going from one speaker to another speaker. You could equalize them, have them both. If you had it at zero, they'd both be at the same volume. But as you move it either to the left or right, you'll present more energy to the speaker that you're swinging the pot to.
Good. Yeah, I'm about to pass it over to Eric, because what I just described would not give you a continuous proper impedance match. It would take a more complicated network of a pair of pads going to the left-hand speaker and a pair of potentiometers going to the left-hand speaker and a pair of potentiometers going to the right-hand speaker. You've worked with a lot of fancy audio circuits. Tell us how this is normally done, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. In many audio systems, L-pads are typically used as remote volume controls at the speaker level. The concept is to maintain a constant impedance to the amplifier as you raise and lower the amount of energy going through the speaker. There are audio L-pads sold as an assembly, which is two pots wired concurrently to each other so that the load on the amplifier is always constant. Typically, like in a school situation where they actually send a 70-volt line to power many speakers to many classrooms, there'll be an individual remote volume control at each receiving location, which will be a typical L-pad, which is a wire-wound set of pods, capable of handling 5 or 10 watts of energy, maintains the impedance to the 70-volt line, or an 8-volt, 8-ohm impedance load. You get the idea. If you look in any of the catalogs, you look at an L-pad, most of them are designed for 8-ohm speakers. K2RWK2J. And that's the balancing, just as volume control for individual speakers on a system that's supplying many, many speakers.
So let me describe what I think would be a possible way of doing this, and you tell me whether or not if it's close to the way they did it. If I've got a single shaft coming out that I call volume control in that particular classroom, and as I twist that shaft, I am twisting two individual ganged potentiometers. One of them is between the 70-ohm line and the loudspeaker. The other one is between the loudspeaker and, let me call it ground. And if I have the right ratio between those potentiometers, I can continue to supply the same impedance to the 70-ohm line. I'm not disturbing it. At the same time, the amount of energy getting to the loudspeaker gets smaller and smaller as I increase the pot, the resistance to the 70-ohm line, and decrease the resistance of the potentiometer that's across the loudspeaker. Now it gets less energy, smaller impedance. It's a slightly lossy network. It's got to have the right number of watts of power dissipation. But I continue to supply the same load to the 70-ohm line. Therefore, I don't disturb the rest of the loudspeakers that are in the rest of the school. Is that approximately it, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Let me just say that it's not approximate. That is actually precise. That is the method of distinction.
Now, the reason why that's required is that you could, if you want to, take one single wire-wound high-power potentiometer, wire it across the 70-ohm line, take the wiper of the potentiometer, and connect it to your loudspeaker. That would be a logical-looking way of adjusting the volume to the loudspeaker. The problem is that as you crank that pot more clockwise, where you want more signal going to the loudspeaker, it now is presenting a greater and greater load on the 70-ohm line. The 70-ohm line, therefore, would have a smaller and smaller voltage on it, so that as I crank up the volume in my classroom on this improperly wired circuit, I now would be lowering the volume of every other classroom, and now everybody's going to be twisting their potentiometers, and nobody's going to be happy. Is that approximately what happened if you made a circuit that's too simple in that application? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. That's precisely correct. Think of it this way. If you have an output transformer that has audio on it, and you were to put one side to one end of the pot, and the other side, which you would consider ground, to the other end of the pot, and the wiper would be the speaker, as you go towards the ground side, okay, you would actually be taking, because the speaker is also going to be connected to the ground side, you would actually be presenting a lower and lower impedance to the incoming signal, and that you would actually be dissipating that power in the potentiometer, and therefore lowering the actual amount of voltage available on the positive side of the circuit that would be supplying the rest of the room. So that's the reason for the two pots. Always maintain a constant impedance, a constant load. Of course, when you put 100 rooms together, you wind up putting all these resistors in parallel, and you present a lower and lower load. That's why they use the 70 volts to start with. It gives you the long distance. There are other reasons for it. But once you have a system that's all together, it becomes a constant impedance. And the L-pads maintain the constant impedance no matter what the volume setting is.
Now, let's go one step beyond here, Eric. The good news about the L-pad with the dual potentiometer is that on the 70-ohm line that goes throughout the school, you're constantly putting the same impedance on that line no matter where you twist that volume control. That's the good news. The bad news is that as you crank the volume control to lower and lower numbers, the actual impedance seen by the loudspeaker in that room becomes smaller and smaller. In many cases, that's good because that really is a so-called higher damping factor, and many loudspeakers will behave better as they see a smaller and smaller impedance, a higher damping factor. But because the damping factor is changing, you could get a slight change in the audio characteristics of the loudspeaker, but that's probably a secondary effect that I'm guessing most people don't worry about. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K3J. That is, in essence, correct. Although when we're doing, like, when you do a pool feed, and we're feeding audio to, like, several dozen television and radio organizations, what would you prefer? Would you rather have a high impedance source going into a low impedance load, or would you rather have a low impedance source going into a higher impedance load? What makes you happy?
I'm reasonably sure that the second situation is better. If I have a low impedance 70 ohm source going to a whole bunch of loudspeakers, and people are going to be doing various things and adding and subtracting audio network to that 70 ohm line. If I've got a low enough impedance 70 ohm source, nothing changes very much as I add more loudspeakers to that network. If I had it the other way around, everything is going to be interacting a whole lot more, is my belief. Over to you, Eric.
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, what we'll do is when we have to throw a real fast emergency pool feed together, typically all the users will be, presenting a 600 ohm load. Preferably, you want them to present a 10K load. But in that case, you might use an amplifier which has an 8 ohm output as a DA or a distribution amplifier and hook that into the 600 ohm load. You do the reverse and you wind up with all the distortion products. Same thing with the speaking. That's why the typical, and it's funny, if you want to go back to the 50s and 60s, what we used to call church amplifiers actually used to have 6146 speed in the output. You know, two of them in church. And that would prevent 70 volts, not 70 ohms, 70 volt, a 70 volt line output that would distribute for, almost a quarter of a mile for all these various different speakers. The L-pad would be connected across that, present a constant impedance. You have the volume control for each individual room. Yes, the dampening and distortion factors that occur, but when you're talking about public address, not, it's not like the Doors playing at the Fillmore, thank you, where they like the distortion in the first place, and they're doing, 10,000 watts worth of audio. So, in the public address system, that was the method of choice, and when you get into, like, the New York subway systems in the past, that was the method of choice, and they suffered through the distortion that happened at the lower level. K2RIW, K2J.
This begs an interesting question here now, Eric. If I've got what I believe to be multiple speakers on a 70 ohm line, I'd like it to be reasonably high fidelity. Therefore, each of my loudspeakers has a desired impedance it wants to see in order to give best performance. I think it's possible to make a 3 potentiometer L-pad, where if I taper the potentiometers just the right way, they're all connected to the same shaft, I now have the ability to keep the load on the 70 ohm line constant as I'm running the volume up and down, and with that third potentiometer wired just right, I could keep the impedance seen by the loudspeaker in my room constant as I run that volume up and down. Has anyone ever built a network like that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
That is actually precisely correct, Dick. If you look at the back of, Yuri speakers or Genelec, that's the preferred method that they use before the crossover. And then they will do a dual pad L pad for the higher frequencies, which separates from the master control, which is actually a 3-part assembly. So even though it's a very old way of thinking and a very old technology, it's used in very, very modern types of hi-fi and audiophile type equipment.
I'm getting quite an education here, Eric. So it's a darn good question. We amateurs pride ourselves most of the time of producing reasonably high quality audio. We've all heard heavily speech processed voice on, say, for instance, the 27 megacycle band. where people are only looking at the watt meter and blasting a living daylight out of that microphone circuit to make the watt meter go up high, and the audio you hear over the air can be pretty ugly sounding, or some of the guys using heavy speech processing on the 20 meter band in order to be able to get through a pileup, that's not good audio. As I see it, real good audio has a lot more pleasantness to listen to. And one of the problems I used to run into, for instance, when I was talking on this 420 megacycle single sideband circuit between Long Island and Greensboro, North Carolina, one of the guys in the Charlotte, North Carolina area had an old, I can't think of the brand now, Yaesu. It was a Yaesu 432 megacycle single sideband transmitter that had a kind of audio that the audio chopped off very fast at around 1.2 kilohertz. His transmitting audio had no high-frequency components. So when I was listening to a threshold weak single sideband signal from, in his case, 450 miles away, and all the high-frequency notes were missing, it became very difficult to figure out what he was saying, unless I had gone through a great big learning curve of his particular vocabulary, if you know what I mean. An awful lot of the intelligence of speech really goes out to about 3.5 kilohertz. So when the signal is weak, if the 3.5 kilohertz components are not there, it's very difficult to differentiate between some of the similar sounding words. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, John.
Just one more quick thing, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
We do have amateurs that have come from the CB and the AM concept, and they don't really quite understand that the type of speech processing and the pre-amplified microphones, they think is the most wonderful thing in FM, and really what they do is they degrade the quality of their signal. Built into every one of these FM transmitters is a pre-emphasis and a de-emphasis network, and when you try to conceive that past the deviation index that we do, and that's why the broadcasters have a really, really, really smart way of dealing with it. They actually destroy the integrity of the audio signal rather than improve it. K2RIW, K2RIW.
Okay, so I think you're saying if a person who misunderstands the proper application of the available equipment, he can make some pretty ugly sounding audio. But I'd like to believe your speech processor that's used in the broadcast world to make sure you don't over-deviate on FM or over-modulate on AM, I'd like to believe that that circuit doesn't create distortion components in the process of its doing its function. Over to you, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2EJ. A guy by the name of Bob Auburn and Eric Small spent their lives developing processes that create loudness but yet do not create distortion and over-deviation and splashing. Whereas you will find in the AM world that they will go to a peak modulation of 110%, which is an interesting characteristic, and they would try to get to 100% in FM, which is a whole other game. But, yeah, there's these guys who've spent their lives developing these really intricate circuits that it kind of like rivals what Ray Dolby did in terms of the way he decided to put up the audio spectrum. So it's really complex, and the whole concept was that if you create a louder sound on your station, you're going to impress more people and sell more advertising dollars. It's an interesting concept. But that's another discussion for some other night, because we could talk about it all night. K2RIW, K2J.
Once again, Eric, give me the name of those two gurus of these fancy speech processing circuits. Give me those names one more time.
Now it's interesting because these guys used to work together. One guy's name is Bob Auburn, and you will know out there that there's the Auburn processor, which is the mainstay of FM modulation and FM exciting throughout the broadcast world. And his partner in those days was a guy by the name of Eric Small. Eric used to be the chief engineer of WOR in the late 60s and early 70s, WOR-FM. And he went on to, after working with Bob Auburn, and they had their parting of the ways for their personal reasons, he created a company called Modulation Sciences Incorporated. And they're two very interesting competitors. although of course, you know, it's kind of hard to sell more grid because most of the broadcast stations have this stuff and the lifetime of their equipment, you know, runs into 10, 15, 20 years. And you don't manufacture that much stuff because there ain't that many new broadcast stations. And now also there's a lot of competition.